Conestoga Podcast, number 38, for Tuesday, May 20th, 2008. Here's my interview with Glenn Cook, recorded at Conestoga 11. I'd like to dedicate this podcast to my friend Mike Sweet, who introduced me to Glenn's Black Company books those many years ago. And now, on to the interview. I want to welcome you to the Conestoga Podcast. This afternoon, I have Glenn Cook, author of many, many wonderful novels, and I appreciate you being on the Conestoga Podcast today.
Well, okay. Thank you.
I've had short conversations with you before in the dealer's room because that's where you seem to hang out the most. And for someone who writes so much, you conversationally, you seem to be a man of few words.
That's true. I'm not terribly articulate.
I would certainly disagree with that. At least on paper, you're fairly articulate.
Well, paper, I have time to think. I know what I want to say, and I can make everybody do what I want them to do.
Mm-hmm. Well, speaking of making them do what you want to do, do you ever have problems with any particular characters that they don't do what you expect?
Oh, yeah. When a character comes to life, he does things his way and within the strictures of his character. You can't hardly force them to do things that mm-hmm. you don't want them to do. They're just as bad as people, real-life people. Sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm kind of glad we don't get to meet some of these characters on the street because I don't think we'd survive the encounter.
There's plenty of them out there that are a lot meaner than anybody that I write about.
Yeah. Well, your latest two books, a few months ago I read the first book of the Instrumentality of the Night, The Tyranny of the Night, and I enjoyed it immensely. And, of course, yesterday in the dealer's room I picked up Lord of the Silent Kingdom, which I only, read the first page. But I'm looking forward to reading it. And that just came out, earlier this year?
May, perhaps.
I'm
not entirely certain. It's been out several months. Mm.
Now, is this? Are you just seeing how it does, or are you actually planning another book in that universe?
Well, I'm contracted to do three, and I probably will do four in order to finish the story.
Yeah,
start a story, and it never ends. I start off trying to write a short story, and I get a trilogy. So.
Well, I think most of your fans appreciate that. One of the things that got me about this book is that, I was looking at some other interviews, and this one seems to have, you always have a large cast of characters in your books, and this one, you had a lot of different threads going on, and I was wondering how you're going to try to bring all these characters together, and I wasn't sure, because sometimes you don't bring them together until the next book, but you managed to bring them together in the first book, in the final battle scene at the end. And I thought I was wondering how you're going to pull that off, and but then now there's the next book too. So,
well, I didn't remember it quite that way myself. It's an unusual kind of what I think of as a picaresque kind of novel. It's one guy, basically the central character of the book, is moving through life and. And people who are very important in one chapter simply are not seen again because they're no longer important in his life. It's not mm-hmm. a typical American kind of structure where everything all has to come together and everything be resolved at one point. It's more of the original picaresque novels were Spanish.
Yeah. And, oh, okay. Yeah, one thing I've always enjoyed is because it's to me, obviously, you infuse a lot of history into your novels, and they tend to be modeled somewhat on some real historical events or eras and stuff like that. And I did notice, I got the impression this was, a similar setting around the Mediterranean, an Islam versus Christian type setting.
Yeah, pretty much. It's, you might call it an alternate 12th, 13th century. About the time of the major Crusades, but one of the things I'm doing with the books is playing dirty tricks on the reader. Every time they think, "Oh, I know what this is Frederick Barbarossa and blah 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 blah," and you'll turn the page and it's not. It's one of the things I'm trying to do. I like to play games with the readers.
Mm-hmm. One thing I noticed, I've read the Black Company books. I think I'm missing a few, but I've read the Garrett series. And one thing I've noticed about your characters is that they tend to be fairly ordinary, fairly common, but they're very competent in what they do, and then you throw them into extraordinary situations, and sometimes they're always, they seem to be sometimes just treading water just to try to stay alive.
Yeah. When I first started writing, that was my whole, I wouldn't say goal, but I was tired of books about the princes and whatnot, and I wanted to write. And I think I have, in most cases, written most of my stories from the viewpoint of the people that actually do the work.
Yeah, my friend of mine, Mike, turned me on to your works, and I started with The Black Company. And he said what really impressed him was how you managed to kill off so many major characters in the first book. And you don't get to see that very often.
Well, yeah, I always, from the beginning of my writing, my idea of the perfect novel, the absolute greatest novel that could ever be written, is to create the most lovable possible character and then kill him in about two-thirds of the way through the book.
Some of the more loathsome characters tend to be, wow, I like that character even if he does such bad things.
Yeah, well, again, I don't see the world in black and white, so none of my characters are really black and white, and some of my good guys are really not very nice. And some of my bad guys wouldn't be too bad. You wouldn't mind really having them for the neighbor if they didn't eat children or something.
Yeah. Well, my view of the world has changed. As I've gotten older and, quote-unquote, matured, I remember making a comment to you in the dealer's room many, many years ago, because you've been coming to Conestoga for as long as I can remember, and probably Ocon as well, which is the previous convention, and how I made a comment how I thought your books were a little dark, and I enjoyed them very much. And you said you didn't see them that way. They tend to be a little darker than the world around us, and I think that was probably more my naivety about the world rather than your writing.
Well, I think that's true. My market, unfortunately, is now 21st century North American middle class people that have never in their life had to face bad people or deal with bad situations, and they think that's normal. Historically, that is not normal.
Yeah, it's a blessing and a curse. I mean, it's nice not to have to face those things, but it also distances from what's really going on.
Yeah, people just don't believe. They've grown up in this life, and I think that's what everybody in the world is like and wants to be like, and it's just not true.
Yeah, especially reading history, reading what Cromwell did to Ireland, just reading about it now turns your stomach.
Mm-hmm. That kind of stuff's still going on today.
Yeah. Let's see here. And you certainly do. I gather the impression you dive into history. You read a lot of history because I certainly get a lot of that when I read your works.
Yeah, I don't do pointed or deliberate to the point research. I just every day I have a requirement in my life since high school that I have to read 50 pages of something, and most of what I read is historical or. Strange. Sometimes people would think it's really strange stuff, technical stuff on medieval artillery and stuff like that, which may or may not ever turn up in the books. It's just, but I know about it when I decide to use it.
One of the funner aspects I enjoy about your works is the naming of characters. And although I don't have a list of characters with me right here to list some of the names, maybe I'll put them on the website from some of the books. But it's not something anyone in North America would name their child. But when they roll off your tongue, they sound like a real name, even though they are somewhat unusual.
Yeah, that's one of the games I've played with the reader from the very first thing I ever tried to write is in the Dread Empire series, which I did, which was the first published stuff I did, every single major character's name actually meant something to do with his character, with the name selected from Old German or Old English or something like that. People complained about the names were hard to pronounce. Like, you know, if they went back to 13th century Poland, they would be able to pronounce all the names. So when I did the Black Company, I named everybody very simple names. Mm-hmm. And all the place names were very simple and whatnot. And that's a game I was playing with the reader there, too. So.
Yeah, one thing I noticed about the Black Company series, I don't think I've read the most recent books, but I've read most of them, and I noticed how Croker's character changed, especially as he got involved with the lady as they went to the South. When you originally wrote that series, did you plan that to have that many books, or that's just the way it worked out?
That's one of those things where you start out to write a short story, mm-hmm. and you get a trilogy. Actually, I started out to write one book that I was going to publish in five separate parts in Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction. Mm-hmm. And my agent submitted the material to a publisher, and the publisher rejected it because, for some reason, it was submitted to the horror editor rather than the fantasy editor. Mm-hmm. She rejected it because it was too dark, she said. And there were no people that she liked. And then, as chance would have it, she called me up about 2 months later, said she couldn't get the characters out of her head, even though she didn't like them. Mm-hmm. And so we sat down at a party at a convention and got thoroughly soused together and talked about it for about 6 hours. And what came out of that was a trilogy. And by the time I had finished the trilogy, I knew, you know, a couple more books in the story, and the story just kept going until we came up 10 books.
Wow.
In order to get everything told about the characters. And even so, now I would like to do two more if I get the time, you know, if I live long enough and whatnot.
Well, one thing I've noticed is that in all your fantasy, including the most recent one in the Black Company series, is that you put what I would call science fiction elements in them. And that they have the worlds are self-contained unto themselves. They follow their own rules. The one element in particular was the wind whale, where they were basically it was a gigantic flying carpet. Of course, you had flying carpets in as well. Mm-hmm. And that you actually took a fantasy element and then you worked it out in such a way that made it feel as if this was, you know, that it was realistic, that this is how they would actually use them if they had them, because most time people read fairy tales and, you know, it's like Aladdin.
Yeah, that's something else I've tried to do. I watch currently a lot of young adult TV and a lot of some of the manga, but some other, there's a show that I've really enjoyed called Witch, which is a French TV show based on Italian comic books. But the magic in it is the kind of magic that I don't like. You know, it's never explained, and anytime they need another power, they've got it. Mm-hmm. And when I started writing, I wanted to try to, within certain constraints, you know, stick to the laws of physics and whatnot. And so in the Dread Empire books, they use spells that are on spears and whatnot, but what they do is they turn the spear into a cruise missile. And everything conforms to a set of laws as in that particular world, at least, the laws are as fixed as the laws of physics are here. You can't just turn invisible or something like that. You have to do... Plus, there's a price to the magic. Yeah,
this is true, especially in the Garrett series. Where, well, I mean, it's not. I mean, they're obviously referring to a personal price, but there's also the, you know, they have silver is the reason those wars are going on in the Garrett mm-hmm. series. One of the other things that I just remembered was you master the art of not doing the info dump. You read a chapter and suddenly you realize you learned so much about this world and the characters, and that you do it in such a very masterful way that you know it doesn't come across as an info dump for a particular world. And that's one of the things I have enjoyed about reading your works.
I think I have a problem with putting in too much stuff, because I know all this wonderful stuff that mm-hmm. I want to put in, and I go through a couple of drafts just to get rid of a lot of the info dump stuff, but I still, I think, put in way too much. Mm-hmm. And one of the earliest pieces of advice I got from a professional writer is from Frederick Pohl, and he told me, leave out the boring parts. I mean, if you read it and then mm-hmm. you're skipping over it, you don't need to have it in there in the first place. And so I do like to try to just puts you into the situation, not bother to explain the situation. You learn the situation as you go along, just like the people that are involved in it. They have a history, and as the story goes along, part of their history will unfold. I'm not going to give you 30 pages of where he was born and all of this stuff up front. You're going to start when things are going on. There's a reason to be there.
You know, this is a question a lot of writers get. You know, typically, do you work from outline, or is it fairly detailed, or you just you have an idea, then you run with it?
Generally, I have an idea, and I go, and when I get to the end, I know I'm done. Often, most cases, I have an idea of where I want to go. When the Black Company started to grow beyond its original book, I knew where I wanted to go, but it took me 10 books to get to the end of the story. No outlines. The only time I've ever done an outline, I had to do it for contract purposes. I had to turn it in an outline for the legal department of that particular publisher. So what I did was I took 8 days of 18 to 20 hours a day sitting at the typewriter while my wife and her best friend brought me food and whatnot, and I wrote the book, and then I wrote an outline of what the book was going to be about.
That's certainly one way of doing it. Yeah, and also moving forward to the Tyranny of the Night books, the one thing I liked about it was they used the cannon to kill the Bogon, and is that how you? Well,
yeah,
and that had a it kind of had a feel of some other fantasy, although it's very different in that it's kind of the magic goes away type story. I mean that's what it started off feeling like to me.
That is kind of both the magic in the world itself is, well, I didn't deliberately do it, but it's kind of like petroleum in this world. I mean, there's a finite amount, and the wells are starting to go dry. But it's a world where every imaginable kind of supernatural creature is actually real, and this guy just accidentally stumbles over a way to kill gods, and so the gods are not happy.
No, they're not. And
the books have not come out to be. I wanted to get the kind of a feel that you'd have in a 10th, 11th century Catholic Europe of just every religion is the whole thing and everything and all the time. And I'm so far away from that in my life, and we are so far away from that in this world that I really haven't been able to do what I wanted to do. But still, it's everything is supposed to be influenced and whatnot by the supernatural in this world.
I guess also you throw in several different mythologies. I mean, I could tell like this is supposed to be similar to the Albigensian Crusade, and very much these are the Muslims, and also then you have to throw in the Norse gods in there as well. And I'm still kind of, maybe I didn't pick up on, I'm still kind of wondering where it's going with them, but I will certainly read the books to pick up on that.
Well, they get the Norse gods, or what's left of them, get locked up, and then they find out that by locking them up, they make the situation worse, so they have to figure out a way to unlock them.
Because that was the one thread in the first book that it seemed unrelated to the rest of it. But, I mean, you started pulling them together as they started going around wreaking havoc throughout the novel. And I get the impression that you enjoy wreaking havoc in your novels.
I don't know that I necessarily enjoy it. It's the kind of stuff that I'm writing is about wreaking havoc, and people do it for a living,
Well, it's interesting to see how the characters deal with these situations. I think we've got the first book is Instrumentality of the Night, and a few months ago came out Tyranny of the Night is the first book, and Lord of the Silent Kingdom is the most recent one. Do you have a title for the third one, and do you have a tentative?
Surrender to the Will of the Night is the third book in the trilogy.
And is there a time frame we can expect to see it hit the shelves, or?
No. I'm about 60% done with the book now. I've told my editor that I hope to be able to turn it in by Christmas. I don't know. I've got a lot of stuff on the on my table this year. Kids graduating from college, high school, mm-hmm. son coming home from Iraq and whatnot.
Mm-hmm. Well, that must that must be nice having him come back.
Oh yeah, yeah. He's been out of Iraq for. He was there early on, 15 months early on, and then when the 1st Armored Division went back again, this time he got elected to be the guy in charge of running the operation back in, mm-hmm. still in Germany, so he never had to go the second time. And now he's been in Germany and Iraq for 5 years, and we
wow,
and he had 3 babies in that time and whatnot, and so we're happy to have him home. Yeah, now we got a wedding. My second son's having the whole upper middle class type Mongo Hujo wedding coming up in October, which is we're already working on all of that stuff.
Yeah, I know. You know, regardless of whatever the reasons for the wars, I think it's always it's probably something you worry about when one of your children go over. You know.
Oh yeah, my wife hardly slept for 15 months while he was in Baghdad, and I was very uncomfortable. I got addicted to news television, even though there was no news to see. Every night for 3-4 hours, I was sitting and watching Fox News or CNN or something or other.
Yeah, I mean, it obviously they're in the line of fire, but it does take a toll on the families as well.
Oh yeah, and he brought home some interesting stories that'll probably end up mm-hmm. in books here or there. Now that he's far enough away from it to mm-hmm. talk about it,
I gather that some of the people do active service people read your books, or
they are probably the Black Company. The first 3 books are extremely popular with military people for some reason. I get every convention, I get people that have been in Iraq and whatnot that come by and tell me how wonderful the books are and everything, and how they helped get them through Iraq and whatnot. I had a guy from 5th Special Forces Group that was in the Baghdad area, Ramadi area, before the war actually started, mm-hmm. saying that they fought amongst one another over the Black Company books more than they fought with the Iraqi forces, because they had one set and they had 38 guys or something, or they wanted to read them.
Well, I imagine they get pretty dog-eared.
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, that's always been real pleasing to me that the books went over with the guys who actually mm-hmm. do that kind of stuff for a living.
Well, for those of you listening to this podcast, I know our soldiers are serving overseas. They certainly enjoy having packages sent from home. So help Glenn Cook's sales by buying his books and sending them to the boys overseas.
Yeah, don't send any of them with girls on the cover.
Yeah, they probably get confiscated.
Yeah, they do.
Well, you've got sounds like you've got quite a large family, and
I have 3 sons. And
3 sons, and how many grandkids?
3 grandchildren.
3 grandchildren.
All of them under 2 years old. Twins and a surprise mm-hmm. baby girl that came right up behind the twins mm-hmm. real soon.
Well, that's probably the joy of being a grandparent, is that when you're done playing with them, you can hand them back to their parents.
Oh, yeah. This one's starting to smell bad. take it away.
Give them all the candy and then send them home.
Yeah. Yeah, when they came in from Germany, they stayed with us for 11 days, and it was wonderful to have them there.
Yeah. One of the things, I guess we'll kind of shift gears here a little bit. Now, you come to Conestoga and you sell books, more than just yours, and you do have quite a good selection. How did you get involved in becoming a dealer?
That started out in the early 1980s. A friend of mine and I were starting to go to a lot of cons, and it was costing a little money. And she had a whole bunch of books she didn't want anymore, and I had a whole bunch of duplicates and whatnot. And we started getting a table, and then we had a kind of a business falling out. And I took it too seriously, and she didn't take it seriously enough. And so I bought her out, and it's just been getting bigger every year since. You know, it just kind of keeps growing. And in those days, I had had thought that what I wanted to do when I retired was run a bookstore.
Mm-hmm.
It's no longer possible, no longer feasible to run an independent bookstore. And be able to make enough money to pay the rent, but so I'm not doing that, but I still do it at the conventions.
Yeah, I have a friend who had an independent bookstore in Houston, and he had to shut it down. Fortunately, he didn't have to worry about money, but it just wasn't possible for him to do that anymore. So, and also, I guess it keeps your time occupied, too, being in the dealer's room. You don't have to worry about going on to too many panels, and you get an opportunity to meet your fans as well.
Yeah, I've always enjoyed doing that. I have people walk in, coming to their first con or something or other, and they're always surprised to see me behind a table actually selling my own books and whatnot. Some have outright refused to believe that I'm the same guy that wrote the books. But
I think there's one of your earlier covers is clearly modeled on you. I can't remember. I don't know if it was a Dread Empire book.
There is a Dread Empire book that has a guy on the cover that looks absolutely like I did at that age and at the time that came out. But Kanuko Kraft and I have never met. She's never seen a picture of me. Or I had never seen a picture of me or anything. It's pure serendipity.
That was a happy coincidence.
Yeah. But I use myself as a model for the character in the book, so she probably just drew it from the description of the guy in the book. So.
Yeah. Since you've been writing many, many novels and writing over the years, have you seen a change in the publishing industry as far as your dealings with the editors and publishers and getting your works onto the bookstore shelves? Maybe that's too general a question.
No, I wouldn't say it's too general. I don't have any much contact with the business side of publishing or anything. I write a book, I write whatever I happen to feel like writing, and I send it to my agent, and he finds somebody to publish it. I've done well enough with the Black Company and stuff that Tor seems basically willing to take anything I write. The Instrumentalities of the Night, they accepted simply on the basis of a conversation. There are dramatic changes, I know, in the publishing industry, but I don't bump my nose against them.
Well, that's good. I know that self-promotion can be an important factor, but I think you're popular enough where you don't have to worry about that too much.
Well, I worry about it a little bit because it is a "what have you done for me lately" type of business. If this book sells a little bit less than the last book, then the publisher or the buyers for the chains buy a few less copies, and so it will consequently sell less and less, and some very good writers have disappeared into the cracks simply because unless they find a small press publisher that's willing to publish them, they...
Are you seeing a number of your books going out of print?
A lot of my books are out of print, but I've been lucky enough to get connected with a company called Nightshade Books that have bought all of my backlists and are reprinting them in really nice editions.
Yeah, I've noticed the Science Fiction Book Club does a fairly good job of putting out omnibuses. I don't know how long they keep those in stock, but I have seen a fair number of the Garrett books bundled together.
Yeah, they've done all the Garrett books, all of the Black Company books in those. They come and they go, it seems like. Sometimes they're in print and sometimes they're not. And, right now, I think most all of them are out of print, but they're doing editions of the book club editions of the Nightshade books now. So the Cruel Wind and I can't recall the titles because I didn't create them, but they're doing book club editions of the Nightshade 3-in-1 editions of the Dread Empire books that I did way back.
Well, that's good. And people can always Google and find out for themselves. But I will put some information in the show notes. Earlier you were talking about, your primary audience is 21st century North Americans. Do you find a number of your books being translated into other languages?
The Black Company books have been probably in 25 languages around like that. They did really, really well in Eastern Europe, Poland and Russia. And right now they're doing incredibly well in France. There's like 6-7 different kinds of editions and whatnot of each book, and very substantial. They sound like I'm talking about really big, but it's not big money, but to me it's substantial.
Yeah.
Royalty checks out of France, so I do very, very well in France for some reason.
Now, considering the exchange rate is so bad that the euro is worth so much more, so that that probably helps you.
Yeah, I can't believe the price of like the German editions of the Garrett books were, I think, like 15 euro for a paperback, and so that impressed me there. Just there, the books are so much more expensive in other parts of the world.
Oh, yeah, I've noticed that. We recently traveled to Ireland, and my wife bought a couple of books, and I was like, oh, my goodness. Unless you're just buying the tourist books just because you want to buy them, you're just better off buying them over here.
Oh, yeah. We use, in my business, I used to import British books, and they don't use the euro, but even so, just the retail price of a book in Britain is almost twice what it is here for a paperback, and then you got shipping and all that, so they became impractical to import books.
Are there any books of yours that have gone out of print that you'd like to have reprinted?
Oh yeah, there's a lot of them, but they are going to be all reprinted over the next 2-3 years.
Excellent, excellent. We can, yeah, and for those of us who are going to be waiting for the next book in the Night series, we can always go back and read the other books until that one's ready.
Yeah.
So
everybody should go out and buy at least one copy of every Nightshade book to get the backlist.
Excellent. Are those going to be paperback or trade?
Some of them are. Well, they've done 4 books so far, and 3 of the 4 they've done in hardcover, and the other one they did as a trade paperback. Some of the ones that are already been done in hardcover are going to be done in trade paperback, and now they're talking about doing some of them in regular mass market editions as well. But I think most of the stuff coming down the line will be trade paperback rather than hardcovers. They're doing, although they might do some limited signed editions.
Yeah, I just saw, I don't know if it was a Nightshade book, but I saw a trade paper edition of probably one of my favorite books, is the one with the submarines in space.
Passage
at Arms.
Yes, that's Nightshade.
And that was I think, when I know it kind of tied in with the Starfishers trilogy, correct?
Right, same future.
Same future.
It's like you would call it maybe a prequel, because the people in the Starfishers trilogy are veterans of the war that's going on in Passage at Arms.
Yeah. I think a number of science fiction authors have probably tried to do submarines in space. I mean, obviously Star Trek with the cloaking device. But I think yours probably captured it the best of the ones that I've encountered, because you take advantage, you're not just trying to emulate, you know, regular underwater, you're trying to adapt to the conditions of space.
I tried. I worked really hard on that, probably harder on that book, getting the details right than any other book I've ever written. And I, when they were getting ready to reissue it, I read it for the first time in 20 years, and I was surprised that it was a pretty good book.
When you write science fiction and fantasy, most of your titles tend to be fantasy or sold as fantasy. Is it that you enjoy the fantasy more, or do you find it easier to write than the science fiction ones?
Well, as I moved away from my own age of learning in college and whatnot, I move more and more away. I subscribe to all kinds of magazines that have science stuff in them, popularized, you know, so that I can understand it, because I'm not great on math or anything. But I'm so far away from what's going on in science now that I just don't feel like I can even make it up and fake it well enough to write science fiction anymore. So I just mainly do fantasy.
Okay. Let's see. I don't know if I have any more questions here, but I think we've pretty much covered all the bases, Glenn. I want to thank you again for coming and joining us on the Conestoga podcast.
Oh, you're welcome. Anytime.